Good afternoon, and welcome to Suncoast Tiger Bay Club. My name is Kelly Kirshner. I'm the current president of Tiger Bay, and are grateful to have so many people still interested in politics of the great state of Florida 2 days after our midterm election. Today, we're pleased to welcome Adam Smith, the Tampa Bay Times, and Chris Ingram, founder of 411 Communications and host of the Chris Ingram radio show on 98.3 FM, to give us a recap of what we've just witnessed locally, statewide, and perhaps nationally. They're going to weigh in. The format today will be giving both of our talking heads 7 minutes to speak on the highlights of what they see and things that you as citizens should be aware of what took place and what might be curious, scary, or positive for the future of democracy in the region. And then after that, we're going to open it up to question and answers for all Tiger Bay members. If you aren't a member and you want to ask a question today, you still have time to become a member. You can see Shirley or Megan in the back and become a member if you would like. Last month, we proudly celebrated Tiger Bay's 40th anniversary at the University of South Florida, St. Petersburg. And we'd like to thank all of you who attended, especially our sponsors, for such a memorable evening. If you weren't there or if you were there, please be sure to check out our website and Facebook page to see the photos from the evening and share with those with your friends and social networks, including your friends in Russia. One of the purposes of the Suncoast Tiger Bay Club is to introduce high school students, or affectionately referred to as young tigers, into the discussion of civic issues and personal engagement. Today we have two students and their teacher who have traveled a long way from Palm Harbor High School, and I want to ask them to introduce themselves quickly to us.
Hello, I'm Torin King. I teach economics and sociology, and I'm also the club sponsor slash coach for my speech and debate crew, so that's what I'm looking today.
Hello everyone, my name is Sophia John. I'm a senior at Palm Harbor University High School, and I'm the president of Speech and Debate.
Hello everyone, I'm Kieran Ganga. I'm a junior at Palm Harbor University High School, and I'm the vice president of Speech and Debate.
Ms. King, the teacher, is wearing a blouse with tigers on it, so she's going to get a free membership for this year. You'll probably notice on your table these black bowls that are sitting there. There's no salad in them. The salad that we would request that you add to that is a few dollars out of your pocketbook or your wallet. These donations help us support an annual scholarship for Pinellas County students that we award in April to a graduating senior or seniors who have demonstrated community involvement and leadership and will be the future of leadership, we hope, in this area. So we encourage you to give. We also encourage members to support this Young Tigers program, attending our monthly events, and if you'd like to support the Tigers lunch, please see Megan or myself today about becoming involved. Quick housekeeping note, if you could, please kindly turn off or silence your cell phones and pagers, and also note the Tiger Bay civility code at each of your tables. If you're uncivil, we'll take the mic away, just like Mr. Acosta had his microphone taken away from him yesterday by that White House intern. At this point, we'd like to welcome elected officials and perhaps candidates, if we already want to contemplate that. And Megan's going to help me and walk around the room, and I know we have some newly elected officials as of Tuesday evening as well. If you could just raise your hand for elected officials and candidates, I know there's a few right here in the middle.
Bob Millinger, your friend in the public space.
I'm Nicole, I'm newly elected school board member.
Good afternoon, Ward Fuslowski, City Commissioner, City of St. Pete.
Joanne Lentino, sitting on the Pinellas County School Board.
Good
a judge up front.
Circuit Court Judge Tommy Minkoff and Alicia Minkoff's better money.
Thank you all very much. Remind you, for those of you that are on social media, please use hashtag Tiger Bay today as you're posting some of the insightful pearls of wisdom that our guests will be sharing with us. Special thanks also to Radio St. Pete board member and treasurer Joe Bordeaux for live online broadcasting of today's show. There will be a podcast of that as well if you'd like to share that or listen to it again. We'd like to invite at this point a special presentation that we were unable to give during the 40th anniversary celebration due to extenuating circumstances. And so right now I'd like to welcome public defender Bob Dillinger to the podium to present our Benjamin Franklin Award winner for 2018.
Good afternoon. It's my pleasure today to represent you all and to present to Mr. Bernie McCabe the Ben Franklin Award, which was presented at the 40th anniversary, but Mr. McCabe wasn't with us for, as they said, extenuating circumstances. But let me give you a little background on Mr. McCabe, and they gave me 3 minutes, and I got to talk fast. Bernie McCabe is the Chief Prosecuting Officer for the 6th Judicial Circuit, which is Pinellas and Pasco Counties. He's a native Floridian. He graduated with a Juris Doctor from Stetson University College of Law in 1972. Elected State Attorney in 1992. He also serves on the Juvenile Welfare Board, and he's the Chair of the Finance Committee. He's a member of the Stetson Law Hall of Fame, the Pinellas Police Standards Council, the Tampa Bay Area Chiefs of Police, and is a past president of the Florida Prosecuting Association. The Tiger Bay Ben Franklin Leadership Award is presented to Mr. McCabe for his decades of service to the people of Florida, and based upon his advocating for Timothy Kane's release from prison in 2016. Mr. Kane was an inmate who was imprisoned for life at age 14. Mr. McCabe judiciously pursued, used his position to effect justice to get Mr. Kane a fair and a just hearing and potential for release, since he was sentenced to life in prison at age 14. So, Mr. McCabe, would you come forward to accept your award?
Thank you, Bob. I truly regretted missing that award ceremony. And the reason I have my sympathy stick with me is I had had back surgery at least at, 1 week before the ceremony. And when I was called to say, we're going to give you this award, I said, well, I'm going to try real hard, but I may not be able to make it. And I tried real hard, but I couldn't get up, so I didn't make it. But I truly regretted missing that night. I even heard that Elise Minkoff said nice things about me, which she wouldn't normally do. And I would have been proud to be there with Bob Beach. He was a big part of my career. We tried many large, significant cases together. And I was looking forward to Mayor Landrieu, because I just love that Cajun accent, even when he's talking about tearing down statues. I learned to love the Cajun accent listening to Justin Wilson, the cooking Cajun, for the older people in here that might remember him. But more importantly to me, I'm humbled when I saw the list of previous winners, many of whom are icons in Florida politics. And I truly appreciate this honor. Thank you very much.
Congratulations, Mr. McCabe. Certainly a deserved honor, and I greatly appreciate you. At this point, I'd like to invite Tiger Bay board member Matt Lettler to come forward to introduce our speakers.
I almost got it. Exactly. Yeah, one of these days you'll get it. Good afternoon, Tigers. My name is Matt Lettler. It's my honor to introduce our two guest speakers. But first, I want to congratulate Bernie McCabe on his award. That's a lifetime of service that he's given to this community and well-deserved. Both of our guests today are no stranger to the Tampa Bay area. First up, we have Adam Smith, who is the political editor of the Tampa Bay Times. He focuses on state and national politics. I've known Adam for several years, as he used to live next door to my sister in Old Northeast, and I think that we met over the keg that my sister used to have out during Halloween. So the families could just do laps around her block, and the kids would say, "No, Mommy, we've already been to this house. That's the nice lady with the big silver thing." But that's how Adam and I met many years ago. And he's been with the Times since 1992, so he's been around the block a few times in this area. Our other guest is Chris Ingram, who is a former columnist for the Tampa Tribune and the Tampa Bay Times. He's a native
St. Pete,
and he is the was the youngest Republican Party chair, county chair, in the country at one point at 23 years old up in Georgia. Right now, he is, as Kelly mentioned, he hosts the Chris Ingram Show on News Talk Florida every day from 10 to 12, obviously, except for today, on 820 AM and 98.3 FM. So, gentlemen, please come up, and I think, Adam, you're up first with comments, and then we'll do some questions. So thank you all very much.
Thank you, ma'am. This one. Okay. Thank you for doing this. First of all, I know this is usually a pretty Democratic crowd, so maybe we should all have a moment of silence for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And there will be outside an opportunity to donate your vital organs and your ribs if you want to keep her on the court. I think I'm not going to really give a talk here as much as save time for questions. I will say the race most people are watching. Now we'll be watching the U.S. Senate race for at least a couple weeks now. But I think most people were focused on the Gillum race. I think one of the reasons it was so heartbreaking to so many Democrats was because this was a guy who seemed to do everything that the losing Democrats over the last two decades didn't do. I mean, I've gotten so used to writing these postmortems of the Democrats after every midterm election. We get these quotes saying, "We've sunk lower than we've ever sunk before." And then the next election is, "I didn't think we could possibly sink lower, but we've sunk lower." And now here we are again. But in this case, you had a guy, Andrew Gillum, who not only was a charismatic, exciting candidate, which is something really we have not seen that much on either side of the aisle. Have we seen people that could really give a good speech? He raised money. You know, you go back and you look at Alex Sink and Jim Davis, these were candidates that were sort of boring. They didn't excite the base that much. They were vastly outspent. They had their strengths, but that was the lament there, that these people couldn't, they just weren't exciting the liberals. Then you had Charlie Crist. You know, they tried a woman. They tried a white guy from Tampa. Then they tried a Republican, sort of, in Charlie Crist. And the knock on him was that he spent all his time in sort of Miami-Dade, Broward, and he just didn't do anything up in North Florida and some of those red counties where the Democrats have to keep their margins limited. Andrew Gillum did all that. He not only had money, he not only excited the base, but he was going to all these little counties, Flagler County, Putnam County, Calhoun counties, and getting these monster crowds. And sure enough, they did what they never do. They got their turnout way up. And it just wasn't barely enough. So I think the Democrats are going to keep having that anguished discussion on where do we go from here, what do we need to do. That said, it's looking more and more like that race could well be headed toward a machine recount. And a machine recount, I mean, hopefully for democracy, those machines, when you feed the ballots through again, they won't change those results very much. But then you get to the hand recount, which we're going to probably see both in the Agriculture Commissioner race and the Senate race, and it's going to be who knows what it's going to be, but that's going to be a time-consuming process. And I just have the sense right now that we're about to be in yet another big conversation about how are our election systems going? And I think I know a lot of people who are talking about it over here, the signature issue with so many people voting by mail and questions about the signatures. You've got Broward County, which is so inept at their elections office, it is beyond comprehension. They still have apparently tens of thousands of ballots that they haven't counted yet. And I think we're going to be seeing counties all over the place today, or by Saturday, they have to count all, they have to come up with the results, and there are all kinds of problems with mail ballots where they don't think the signatures fit. And I'm sort of rambling, so I'll hand it over to the A-lister, Chris.
Thanks, Adam. It's good to see y'all here today. I was here yesterday, but y'all weren't here. I put the wrong date on my calendar. The valet knew that Tiger Bay was on Thursday, but I didn't. No, it's a pleasure to be here, and coming off of Adam's comments, I'll talk about the Gillum-DeSantis race as well. I think that Andrew Gillum is not the governor-elect of the state of Florida today for two reasons. Actually, one reason, Andrew Gillum. And the two reasons related to Andrew Gillum are, one, he was labeled with, and we can argue about whether rightly so or not, but with this characterization of him being a democratic socialist, partly by his own fault by embracing Bernie Sanders, who is in fact a democratic socialist, and by calling for a $1 billion tax on businesses in the state of Florida. I think had he not done those two things, Andrew Gillum would be the governor-elect of the state of Florida today. So the Democrats can, you know, try to reassess and lick their wounds and whatnot, but really this was their own making that he is not, in fact, the next governor of the state of Florida. Now, you can agree or disagree with me with that, but if we look at Ron DeSantis, there was not a whole lot to like about Ron DeSantis. There really wasn't. I voted for him. I had him on my radio show several times. You know, he's an okay guy, but I told several people, you know, if I had the choice of going out and hanging out with either Ron DeSantis or Andrew Gillum for the proverbial beer, I would have picked Andrew Gillum in a heartbeat. And I'm a firm believer, I've said it for years, that people, they won't consciously tell you, they won't tell pollsters this, they won't, most of you, if I asked you this question, do you vote for a person based on whether you like them as a person or not versus do you think things like their resume, their background, their experience, their education, their knowledge, and their vision for the future are more important, or the guy that you want to go have a beer with? Most people will not consciously tell you, I'd vote for the guy that I want to go have the beer with, but subconsciously, when you get in that voting booth or, you know, you're at home filling out your ballot, as we do now, that comes into play. And Andrew Gillum was, like Adam said, a really likable guy. So I think that the Democrats, when they think about this election and reassessing it, really need to think about what their message was and what it could have been or what it should not have been in moving forward in the future. He would be the governor, in my opinion, if it were not for that. I mean, Ron DeSantis, I went as a Republican and looked on his website one day back in the summer looking for, okay, well, what are a couple of the things that Ron DeSantis stands for? You know this. And probably a lot of you. You go to the Issues tab on his webpage, and it clicked, and there's nothing there. I mean, literally, there was nothing there. And I understand as a former political consultant for years why, you know, you want to advise your candidates not to say too much, but for crying out loud, say something. Yeah, really. And there just wasn't a whole lot there. There wasn't a whole lot to like. He's not warm and fuzzy. And yet he's going to be our next governor. Now, personally, as a conservative, fiscal conservative, more social moderate, but definitely a Republican, I'm happy about the outcome. But the Democrats really kicked themselves. Andrew Gillum kicked himself. And also want to say about the Senate race versus comparing the numbers in the Senate race and Rick Scott versus Ron DeSantis' numbers. I actually predicted, they make us predict on Bay News 9 on election night when I'm up there on general election nights, you know, just for fun, we pick. My Democrat counterpart this Tuesday was Ed Norain. And Al Rochelle has us each pick. Who do you think is going to win in the two marquee races, in this case, governor and Senate? And then we do like a little crystal ball tiebreaker on the pick of the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate, what the final numbers are going to be. So as it relates to the top two races in Florida, I said I thought Ron DeSantis was going to win by half a point, and I thought that Bill Nelson was going to beat Rick Scott by 1 point. And that, I mean, 1 point ain't going to happen, but it's still not a done deal, as we see now, that Nelson could, in fact, with his recount, you know, turn it. I don't think it will. Historically, the data doesn't suggest that the statistics don't suggest that he's going to be able to overcome that deficit. But who knows? It's Florida, after all. The reason why I thought that the Democrat, Bill Nelson, was going to win in the Senate race is because Rick Scott alienated so many Republicans. He's never been warm and fuzzy within the party. I know me personally, I was very turned off. In fact, on my radio show back in March or April, whenever he came out and signed the HB 631, the beach ban bill, I said, he's done. I'm not going to vote for this guy. I ended up voting for him. But I believed it when I said it. I said, I'm not going to vote for this guy because he has just signed a bill that basically has given credibility to all the things that I think that Democrats falsely charge Republicans for about being for the rich, the big guy, and ignoring the little guy. I'm a little guy. I want to go down on the beach and sit on the white soft sand that's dry, not in the water that's mucky. And I just thought that if every Democrat in the state had run against HB 631, there would have been a different outcome in this election. I really believe that because it was very off-putting. So Rick Scott had that I think hurt him, is why his numbers weren't as strong. And also, I think that the fact that his opponent, Bill Nelson, is so milquetoast, we don't know anything about him other than he went into outer space. I mean, seriously, what signature issue can you point to that Bill Nelson has accomplished in his 40-plus years in public office? There is not one. And he was not running, Rick Scott was not running against someone who was highly controversial vis-a-vis the embracement of democratic socialism, and that's why I thought we were going to see a different outcome in the Senate race as it relates to the Democrat being a Republican versus my prediction that the Republican would win in the gubernatorial race. So I'll stop it at that, and what do we do, turn it over to questions now?
Yes. If you want, Chris, maybe you can call first.
Sure, yes, ma'am. And tell us who you want to answer the question, I guess. Is that kind of the protocol here?
Hi, my name is Judy Beck. And my question is for both of you. It's the question that has been running through my mind ever since I woke up yesterday. Do you think Andrew Gillum would have won if he were white?
That's a fair question. I mean, you can't ignore the fact that, one, that he's black, nor that the racial issues were a component of this campaign, fairly or unfairly. They absolutely were. I do not doubt that there are people in the state of Florida that did not vote for him simply because he was white. I can tell you, me personally, as a conservative, fiscally conservative-leaning Republican, as I said before, I'm socially kind of moderate. I point that out because I think it's relevant. I did not vote for Andrew Gillum, not because he's black. I voted for him because his ideology scared the hell out of me. Not given the ideology that was either expressed or implied by his campaign of democratic socialism. I think that would have been rejected even if Andrew Gillum had been white.
I think it's a great question, and I'm writing a story about that, so I want to talk to you. Don't go before I have a chance to talk to you. And I don't know the answer to that. I don't think we will ever know the answer to that. There's this thing people call the Bradley effect, which was Tom Bradley was, you know, the polls sort of show one thing because people don't want to say they're not going to vote against the black guy. But there's been questions. The answer is, I don't know. It's clearly odd that, you know, the polls consistently showed him overperforming Bill Nelson. He ended up underperforming Bill Nelson. But I will say this, you know, I have a focus group of one in this case, a guy I know who was watching, who was leaning toward Gillum pretty strongly, and he watched the debate, and he was so turned off by Gillum playing the race card, you know, when he's asked about, I see some of my Democratic friends ready to kill me. He was asked about the FBI investigation, which was a very valid issue, and Gillum immediately responded by talking about your stereotyping black people. And that was a strategy the Gillum campaign used. So he was absolutely right in that great comic quote about, I'm not saying Ron DeSantis is a racist, but a lot of racists think he's a racist. But he also played racial politics too. Yeah.
So I have a question. So when Gwen Graham my name is Shannon Love. When Gwen Graham ran, she ran on a 67-county strategy. I think that what you saw was you saw Andrew Gillum taking that approach and going to places like Polk County, Putnam County. Did he make a mistake by not spending more time in purely South Florida to drive the turnout?
Well, I'll start, but I think no. I think he did do a 67 county strategy, and I think a lot of Republicans thought that that Gillum was going to win, and they were already having this discussion. If only we'd nominated Adam Putnam, this wouldn't even be close. And now you're going to start to see Democrats say, if only we'd nominated Gwen Graham, we'd be there. I think you'd have to question whether Gwen Graham was going to excite the base in a way that Gillum did.
I don't necessarily think that his strategy was flawed, although I think he probably should have spent more time in some of the bigger counties. He won Duval County, but not with large enough numbers that it could have affected the race. That was a natural place where he probably should have been and spending more time. But, you know, it's easy to Monday morning quarterback these things. The hard part is figuring out what to do before the election. Yeah, Joni? Okay.
My name is Barkley from St. Petersburg. The question for both of you, given the generational divide over partisanship in the vote turnout and also the passage of Amendment 4, what do you think that says for the future of Florida politics 10, 15 years down the road?
It's a problem for Republicans, probably. But, you know, we talked specifically about the younger voters. I know I was talking to my friend Tara Newsom here, who's a professor at St. Pete College, and she told me, I think, what you said, 11% or 13% turnout among the younger voters, millennials. And every year we talk about, oh, the young voters are motivated. And guess what? Every year the younger voters are not motivated. I don't know why campaigns put all this emphasis on younger voters when they just historically don't turn out. But, yeah, I think it is a problem that at least ideologically, it seems at this time that younger voters are trending to be more left-leaning, and that's problematic for the Democrats, or for the Republicans, rather. But who knows? I mean, anything can happen in 5 years.
Yeah, but young voters did turn out more. Their turnout sucked, but there were at least 100,000 more young people turning out this time. Problem was that everybody else turned out more, so they compensated for it.
Hi, I'm Joni James. I'm curious, given that we have a strong
Republican... Yes.
Can we see your papers, please?
Who let her in?
And this would be for both of you, but given that we are returning to Tallahassee a strong Republican majority in the legislature, we're returning a conservative Republican governor, given we just had another mass shooting this morning in California, given what happened in Tallahassee, do you see the gun issue coming back at all in Tallahassee in the spring?
Well, first of all, something I forgot to say in this opening, when I was saying all that glum stuff about the Democrats, they also picked up 10 Florida House seats. That's pretty impressive. They picked up probably this very competitive state Senate seat in Tampa, the Dana Young, Janet Cruz seat, and they picked up two congressional seats, so our delegation, congressional delegation, sort of looks like Florida, 13-14 on both sides. That said, no, I don't think so. I think it's just poison to the majority party, doesn't want to do anything about gun control. And I think the only reason it happened last time was because Rick Scott was running for U.S. Senate and didn't have a primary. So he felt comfortable enough to do the tiniest little bit of gun control so he could reach out to the middle. So I think no.
Yeah, I tend to agree with Adam. I don't think they will unless they have to. And I was talking about this on my show today. Given the events of what happened in California last night, clearly something needs to be done. The question is what? I mean, I really don't know. I'm a gun owner. I'm a Second Amendment rights supporter, but I'm not, you know, on the fringe of that. I think some reasonable changes need to be made, but the NRA is pretty dug in on this, and they're not going to let up in any time future, certainly not here in Florida with Marion Hammer at the helm.
Just quickly, and the irony is our legislature, I'm going to sound partisan here, but our legislature is so against expanding Medicaid, and their knee-jerk on gun control is we need better mental health services. Well, that would do a big, big leap in that direction.
Due to the past election, I want to know how the demographics, specifically the brown in America, might undo that.
Quickly, I think the conventional wisdom has been for more than 10 years that the Republican Party needs to grapple with the changing demographics in America. Things are changing. They're going to be go the way of the Whigs if they don't do that. And then Donald Trump showed up and sort of threw that out the window because he seems to have motivated a lot of white voters that weren't turning out to the polls. So ultimately, unless the Republican Party does better, especially among Hispanics and African Americans, and by the way, the exit polls showed that DeSantis got 14% of the African American vote, which is not bad. But you know, long term, that's a serious issue for the Republicans. But not yet.
And we are improving. There was a New York Times article, I believe, right after Mitt Romney lost to Barack Obama, that basically projected there will never be another Republican president elected in the United States if the demographic trends continue in this country and if those corresponding demographics tend to vote the way they were voting at that time. And then, as Adam kind of said, then along came Donald Trump and upended everything. I don't think that there are any real concrete answers to that question or predictions of it. We do see some changes. I think the Republican Party is actually doing better at attracting minority candidates and paying attention to some minority issues, but clearly there's a lot of room to grow, and I wouldn't say that room to improve, but room to grow, because a Democrat's opinion or philosophy on what the Republican Party ought to be doing to improve its appeal to minority groups is completely different from a Republican's, and those being, you know, small government, entrepreneurship, self-reliance, as opposed to whatever the Democrats' philosophy are. So if you're a Democrat telling Republicans how to appeal to minorities, we're not listening to you, but thank you for the advice. Yes, gentleman right here. Oh, sorry, go ahead. Get him next.
Michael Vivio, are you all seeing evidence of the hostility to the press in Florida that we're seeing in Washington right now?
Well, I wanted to strangle Adam when he walked in, but no. yeah, I think that there's animosity toward the press. But I think some of it is deserved from the standpoint of a conservative who looks at a lot of things that come out of the media that just don't look fair. And I find that the media, when I'm talking to active members of the news media, whether it's print or television, and if you're critical of their product, they get very, very defensive. And I think until such time as the media can more objectively reflect on the product that it produces, we're going to continue to have this type of animosity, because the animosity is driven by what a lot of people on the right seem as just an unfair handshake. And I think that, again, some of it's deserved. I don't condone in any way violence or anything of that nature, but, you know, calling them out on it, I think, is fully appropriate. Adam?
I don't know why I have to stand next to this hat. no, I think that I agree with a lot of what Chris said in terms of have I been seen it personally. Sometimes, you know, I think there's a knee-jerk among a lot of the most hardcore Republicans assumption that, you know, I'm the kind of Democrat that Chris is painting all Democrats as wanting Venezuela. But I also would say that, you know, there's a lot of attention on these Trump rallies and the sort of violent vibe that you get at these Trump rallies. I've been to a lot of them, at least a couple dozen of them, and you find they stick you behind this barrier, and people are jeering. You know, Trump is stirring them up and calling us the enemy of the people. People are jeering, and you're looking, and you're like, that woman looks like my grandmother, and she's just looking like she would like to shoot me. What is going on? But then you go out in the crowd and talk to people one-on-one, and they're delightful. There's never been any issue like that. So I also think everybody's talking about Jim Acosta, which is a way for us to not talk about the firing the Attorney General thing. But I also think when you see him, in my opinion, just be a jerk, it makes us all look bad. And I think when you turn on a couple of the cable news networks, and it's just relentless, all they talk about is how terrible Trump is. You can't even find out what's happening in the rest of the world. I think it's such piling on that helps feed an animosity, too.
But if I would just want to add to that also. outside of politics, forget about politics, the content of the media, particularly in the television media, not so much the print media, the content of the media, it is absolutely appalling. I have my master's degree in journalism. I have a lot of respect for the profession of journalism. I look at things like the NBC Nightly News, like how many dinosaurs actually watch that kind of stuff anymore, but I do. I get a kick out of it. And there's no news. It's school bus crash and, you know, the stupid pet tricks on the morning news, and it's just nonsense. I mean, how many of you have real credibility or think that the television news networks, whether it's Fox, NBC, CBS, whatever, have real credibility? Do you think that they're really providing news? It's not. It's infotainment, if anything, at best. Gentleman right here.
Tom, why does the Republican message work in rural areas and it doesn't work so well in urban areas?
Well, I think clearly the voters are different. I mean, you might as well be in a different state if you're up in the Panhandle versus in Miami or downtown Tampa. Just clearly different demographics, different interests, different needs. I don't find that that's a particularly unique phenomenon.
I think that is the greatest question facing Democrats. I think it's basically a cultural thing, but I think if the Democrats had a message that could, you know, if there's this book, What's the Matter with Kansas, which is sort of like, why are all these working class voters flocking to the Republican Party when the Democratic big government programs are the ones that would help them the most, arguably, and I think it's all cultural, and I think Democrats haven't cracked the code. Yeah.
I'm number 146. I'm a new member. I don't know if there's a rule about how many questions you can have. My name is Alex, and my question is, how does the Republican Party recover from this Pyrrhic victory? The people of the state of Florida have insisted that 1 million people 2 years from now will be voting, and they're probably not going to register as Republicans. The president did not help hold Nevada, New Mexico, lost Wisconsin, didn't flip Pennsylvania. He doesn't have the numbers. So why is this conversation that this is not the last hurrah? He's a lame duck president as of today.
Well, who's that candidate again who looks so strong on the Democratic side to take him down? I forgot because I haven't seen him, unless it's Beto O'Rourke, maybe. But I think, you know, you look in Florida, and the numbers are there, too. There's more Democratic voter registration, and the issue is a lot of the voters just don't turn out. And I think you're going to find a lot of those people that get their voting rights back are not necessarily going to turn out.
And I would just add, the epitaph of Donald Trump has been stated so many times, I can't even remember. And I wouldn't underestimate him. I wouldn't take him for granted that he could pull this off again 2 years from now.
Bill Johnson, switching subjects a little bit, why do you think so many of the amendments passed when there was so much concern about them not getting 60%?
Well, I would say you could ask a question on the ballot that's an amendment. You know, should chicken sandwiches be served every Tuesday for free down at Shoney's? And voters would pass it. They're written that way intentionally. I actually did a column on this subject a few years ago for the Tribune. And my memory serves me right, 87% of all the amendments since 1976 that passed had a yes response that was, you know, elicited and intentionally written to be for a yes response, because people prefer to be for something as opposed to against something. I mean, it's just simple psychology, really. I tell you what, there were only three amendments that I voted for, in favor of, and one of them was amendment number 2, which was their, I'm sorry, let me back up. One of the ones that I saw that passed, that did not pass, that I was also against, was amendment number 1. And I think that it was encouraging in that it showed voters, number 1 was the one that would increase the property tax, homestead exemption by $25,000. And I think it showed that voters saw it for what it is, which is it's just bucking it to the local communities, that it was a pass from the state legislature to put the onus of the programs that the local communities want. And I was pretty impressed by that, because these are not written in a way that are always easy to decipher.
There have been, I'm not going to challenge the 87% passed over the years, but there have been years that the CRC, Constitutional Revision Commission, has been shot down on every single one. So I was surprised that so many of them passed, and the reason is I have no idea.
Bob Heyman, a two-pronged question, one half each of you. First to you, Adam. Since so many of the insider experts you write about and quote at significant length so often seem to get it wrong, I wonder if you might want to rethink the amount of ink you give to them. And then to your conservative colleague, since you raised the subject and said there's a lot of things you see in the mainstream media, but you really say that is wrong, that's false, it's unfair, whatever. Since you raised the subject, would you give us a list of about, just say, 4, 5, or 6 of those things?
Well, we do this insider poll where we survey 200, 300 people that are closely involved in politics, some political scientists, some pollsters, etc. And you can take it to the bank. Whatever they predict is wrong. Every single time. And it's just unbelievable to the point that both Andrew Gillum specifically mentioned it to me. Oh no, your polls have me up. Your people are predicting I'm going to win. And so did Rick Scott's. At the end, Bill Nelson, our insider poll that we took on the Sunday before election, predicted that Bill Nelson was up, and he texted me saying, "We're now I can breathe easy."
To answer your question specifically, I can give you an example that I saw this morning. I was getting ready to go in to do my show, had the TV on while I was getting dressed, and the Today Show was on, and one of the hosts, I forget which one, was referencing the issue of the Attorney General out of a job, and they said that Attorney General Sessions was fired. Well, technically, that's not true. He turned in his resignation. If you've ever been in an employment situation, whether an employer or an employee, and your boss comes to you, or you as the boss come to someone and say, I would like for you to turn in your resignation, they're giving you an opportunity to avoid being fired. So there's a distinction there, and it is splitting hairs a little bit. But the fact of the matter is, as a journalist, your duty is to provide the truth, to be fair, and to be accurate. And they were lacking accuracy in that story. And it wasn't just a slip of the tongue of the host, because the Chiron down below the video that has, you know, a little narrative of what's going on said, Attorney General Sessions fired, when in fact he resigned. Now, to be completely accurate, they should have said it was basically a forced resignation, but they stated it as though Donald Trump called him up in the middle of the night and said, your ass is out of here, and that's just not true.
Come on. If that, I could come up with 6 or 7 better examples than that. I mean, the guy was fired. I mean, yes, no. They should have said technically he was resigned, but there's not a human being that thinks he wasn't pushed out and effectively fired.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. But the issue for the media is accuracy, and the erosion of accuracy lends to greater credibility that there is, in fact, a problem with fake news. Gentleman in the back. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
How do you think the blue wave in the House will affect significant pieces of legislation or even the 2020 election?
The blue wave in Congress, in the House, the House being
the House.
Blue? I think that the Democrats will play right into Donald Trump's hands. He loves to pick a fight. He's good at picking fights. He's good at ending fights in his favor. And it will help him in his prospects in 2020. He no longer needs to pick on the so-called rhinos with his own party. He can now pick on the crazies in Congress.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's going to be an issue. We still have divided government. And we had gridlock practically when we didn't have divided government on a lot of these issues. But I think the big question is the Democratic House going to be mostly, the Democratic majority going to be mostly fixated on investigations and subpoenas and impeachment, or are they going to do, which clearly some of that may well be perfectly appropriate, but or are they going to do what Nancy Pelosi has sort of indicated, and they're going to be trying to focus on issues that actually matter to most people.
The guy in the red back there.
Let's do. Oh yeah, I'm sorry. No, go red.
Thank you, Dick Haber. I have a question that has to do with, to me, the elephant in the room in the case of the Scott narrow victory here, if that's what it turns out to be, is
money.
The use of millions and millions and millions of his own money. For all we rail about the whole Citizens United decision and changing campaign financing, I don't think we fully anticipated people just jumping up and buying a spot in Congress, which is my view of that. You two guys, much better versed in this than many of us, have any vision of campaign finance reform that has any potential to make a difference?
I hate that I keep sounding like I'm pro-Democrat on some of these things you're putting. But yeah, I think the only reason, the only way there's legislation to overturn Citizens United is if there's a Democratic Congress. But that said, both houses. But that said, Scott spent $65 million of his own money this time. There was no Senate race where more money was spent in the country, and he basically tied. So, you know, there has been election after election in Florida where the Democrat has been outspent 2-1, 3-1, and they basically tie. So money doesn't always decide elections.
Well, Andrew Gillum in the primary is a perfect example of money doesn't always determine elections. I don't know what the answer is to the problem with money in politics. It clearly is a problem. I have a problem with it. I have a problem with Rick Scott spending $60 million of his own money, but I also have a lot of respect for the First Amendment and, you know, his desire to want to spend his own money and do that thing. Where do you draw the line? I don't know what the answer is, but it is clearly a problem that needs to be addressed, but nobody's come up with a good solution, just like gun control. Gary here.
Thank you. Kelly Kirshner, I was wondering if you could talk about the caravan and contextualize that and the importance nationally and in the state, and then the historic precedent that it sets for a group of a couple hundred, primarily women and children, 1,000 miles away from the border of the U.S., and mobilizing thousands of troops, and then maybe forecast for us how much longer this will be covered by the media of this invading horde to the south of us.
Well, first, I would say the reason why you saw Donald Trump make such a big issue out of this is because it motivates the base. That's kind of the no-brainer part of the question. The issue of the caravan, I think, is obviously complicated. I know as a person who's compassionate toward others, I hate to see people suffering. But I've been around the world to places like Sudan and Kenya and seen poverty. There's poverty all around the world. We as a country cannot be welcoming to every person in this world that has a bad plight. I mean, we can be welcoming, but we have to do it in an orderly fashion. We can't simply just ignore the fact that we are a nation of laws, and that we have a border, and that security of that border is important to our national security. Now, are these people a threat to our country? No, absolutely not. But I just think that from the standpoint of we are a nation of laws, we have to maintain the rule of law and order, and just because someone has a plight that they are escaping from, that they want to have a better future, doesn't mean that we just throw out the laws and look the other way and allow them to come in. We should continue to have an orderly fashion to allow people who are escaping whatever political problems that they're facing in their country to come into our country in an orderly fashion. But I stand by the president in his call for maintaining border security, for sure.
I keep looking at the spinner because I'm expecting these marauding hordes to climb up. No, I think he's right. It was a complete play to the base. And, you know, maybe you think it makes sense to send thousands of troops, more than we have fighting ISIS, to stop these people. I don't. And I think basically they were following the law. I mean, the law says migrants can come here and we'll review their status. And if there's a legitimate reason for that men in fear for their lives, they can come here. If not, they'll be sent away.
Sue Landris, this question is basically for Adam. What do you think the problem is at the Tampa Bay Times, that their recommendations are been ignored repeatedly in the past couple elections?
Joni? I don't think many people. I would like to know how did the judicial races turn out? I bet they had a pretty good record on those. Not so good? What? Jeez. I don't know. I don't think people, certainly, nobody listens. I think Yeah, I got no good answer. not many people are listening to those recommendations anymore. But I do think they can give, even if you don't follow them, or if you just assume you're going to do the opposite, they will help educate you. But yeah, I'm not giving that one.
Nah.
Good afternoon. Amy Mullen with Doyle Wealth Management. So you talked a little bit about polling earlier. When we look at polling for the last 4, 5, 6 years or so, they're vastly wrong. What are we doing with polling? Are all the polling, is it just, you know, insiders? Are you polling people? Are you struggling to get people don't have landlines? Or where are polls coming from? Who's doing them and why are they really wrong?
Well, they're not always vastly wrong. If you look at in Florida at least, they were wrong, but they weren't vastly wrong. And in the prior elections, you know, they had Gillum and Nelson up, if you average the polls out, by about 2 points. So it's these pesky margins of error. And if you look at the last 4, 5, or 6 really close races in Florida, they were either pretty much on or about a percentage point off. So, but yeah, I have real concerns about the polls, and I think it was especially tricky this year when you have all these unlikely voters coming out, and nobody's quite figured out who are all these Trump voters, and yeah, when these robocalls, they don't get any cell phones, so I think they were a real problem, and yeah.
Well, I would say, yeah, I agree with Adam. I mean, they were wrong, but they weren't wrong. I mean, if you really understand polling, I've done polling professionally for years. And you need to understand the details of the poll, particularly the confidence level. Sometimes if you read the fine print in a poll, you understand what the confidence level is. And basically what that is, they say this poll has a margin of error of plus or minus, let's just call it 5%, at the 95% confidence level. So what that means is if you did this poll 100 times, 95 times out of 100, that poll would be within the margin of error as stated in the one time that they released poll results. 5 times you're going to get it wrong, and then 95 times it's going to be plus or minus 5%, which is a wide range. So truly, the polls are actually accurate in the sense that they're within the margin of error at the 95% confidence level. But the polls that get reported and the public's ability to understand and digest that, what I just explained, is really non-existent. The media doesn't even try to explain it. But to your point, clearly things have changed because polls used to not be so wrong. And I think a lot of pollsters are still having trouble identifying the right people to call, because that's part of it, okay? It's your sample, the people you're calling. It's your instrument, the actual survey questions that you ask, the skip patterns and so forth. And then it's interpretive. Polling is part art and part science. And I think that we probably lost some of the scientific side of polling through no fault of any specific pollsters, just a change in society and technology and whatnot. And so there's more emphasis on the artful side, and the artful side is more prone to go wrong.
And I would just say the press does need to start being more disciplined. I've tried to stop. It's like crack. You look at these polls, and you're obsessed about these polls. But, you know, you look at the people look at the 538 and Nate Silver and some of those, and they'll say, no, we didn't get it wrong. We said there was an 85% chance that Andrew Gillum would win, or we said there was a 95% chance that Donald Trump would win. So we were right. There was just that 5% people that, well, come on. Nobody gets that. So I think polls are most valuable in terms of telling you the issues that matter to people and more, but unfortunately we use them mostly to say who's going to win and who's not.
This is going to be our last question.
This is a follow-up. This is a follow-up on the poll question. With so many people having cell phones and disconnecting their landline phones, what impact does that have on telephone polling?
What about the what?
What impact does people having cell phones have on telephone polling when so many people are giving up their landlines?
Yeah, it has a big impact, and it's because especially with these robo-polls, they don't get cell phone numbers, and so that tends to disproportionately undercount young voters and minority voters, for whatever reason. I mean, they're the ones. I mean, how many people here have a landline anymore? Not many. So, yeah, it has a big impact.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I don't know that I have really anything to add to that, because what Adam said is completely true, other than how is it that everybody trying to sell me solar panels and a new air conditioning has my cell phone number, but the pollsters don't? Is that it? All right, well, thank you all very much. I reject the assertion of your question, and if you're watching the results come in on Tuesday night, we no longer have one-party rule. The House of Representatives is now in Democratic hands.
Yeah, and all these races. You know, Donald Trump lost the popular vote and barely won the electoral vote. You know, the top of the tickets in Florida were basically ties. So I don't think there's at all an appetite for one-party domination in America by the voters.
Chris and Adam, thank you both very much. It's clear you're not enemies of the state nor of one another. Greatly appreciate your participation today. We have tallied the scores for our Fang and Claw, and the winner is Sue Landris, wondering why the Tampa Bay Times recommendations are always ignored. So, Sue, if you could come up. Well, she comes up. We have coffee mugs for both of our guests today, and we're going to have a plush tiger for Sue, and we're going to get a photo afterwards with her. Remind you that the last program of the year will be December 13th. We might try to get a governor or a senator here, so stay tuned to your emails to join us for that. For those of you who are guests, please sign up to become a member today. Thank you all very much, and have a safe and wonderful Thanksgiving.
You've been listening to another live broadcast of the Suncoast Tiger Bay Club meeting today at the St. Petersburg Yacht Club. Radio talk show host Chris Ingram and Tampa Bay Times political editor Adam Smith were our speakers. And Kelly Kirshner moderated most of the program, president of Tiger Bay. Stay tuned with us for further coverage of these Tiger Bay Club luncheons. The next program coming up December the 13th. This has been a public affairs presentation of RadioSt.Pete.com. I'm Joe Bordeaux. Thank you so much for tuning in. From the Yacht Club in St. Petersburg, we return you now to our studio.
Radio, radio, St. Pete.
What'll I do about this heart of mine? It keeps breaking all the time, and I wonder if I'll win in the end. I wonder.